So there are a number of queries about some basic synaptic physiology. So tomorrow, Sebastian will give a short sort of review of sort of the transmitterology and time scales on neurotransmission, right? Sort of high autotrophic, metabotrophic, the usual story. Okay, so today Misha is going to start, and Misha is fitting with his background. He's going to do sort of the heavy stuff and describe the Hopfield model and describe what was sort of a major intellectual triumph in solving the statistical mechanics of the Hopfield model and introduce a lot of ideas like the capacity of the network, how much stuff you could actually store in a network of interacting neurons.
Okay, just to complete the preview. So first I'll talk about the Hopfield model, then David will talk about some extension of the Hopfield model to a model of generating the sequences. And then afternoon we'll have a guest lecture of Udi Zohari, who is an experimentalist who studies memories in monkeys, the neuronal mechanism of memory in monkeys. He will talk about his experiments and some other labs' experiments on the memories in monkeys. And then, if everything goes well, I hope we'll have some discussion about the general problem of memory and the relevance of the models to understand the memory, mechanisms of memory, all these things. So, hope it all will all work out. But as David said, I'm now up for hard stuff. I'll have to tell you about almost 10 years of very heavy work of all the community of statistical physicists who studied the Hopfield model beginning from the middle of 80s and up to beginning of 90s. So the role of the Hopfield model in the theoretical neuroscience is pretty unique. And at that time, Hopfield model was basically theoretical neuroscience for many, many people, or at least for most of the physicists who got interested in the problem of memory. All theoretical neuroscience was the Hopfield model. And you'll probably see why if you don't know already. So, very advanced techniques, sort of on the cutting edge of statistical physics, were applied to the analysis of this model. So this is pretty unique situation even now, that the model, which was under overall motivated by biological problem, was analyzed with very advanced tools of theoretical physics, and a lot of results were obtained. You may ask why this activity sort of decayed after the beginning or the middle of 90s. I think mostly because the results obtained were of such a detailed nature that the experiments just couldn't catch up with them. So it was still very hard to think about the experiments which would directly test all these very detailed and complicated results which were obtained by the analysis. But I think the main ideas are still around, and I think the reason I decided to tell you about this model is that first, we don't know, maybe one day when the experiments will advance and the technology, this can be revisited, and this happened in science many, many times when the problems which were just ahead of their time were then revisited after the technology was improved sufficiently. And also, some of the ideas which were developed in this work were applied then later in other fields. And so I think it's a good idea for you to have if not command of these techniques, but at least some appreciation of the level which of the analysis which can be reached. And another reason is that the techniques themselves are very beautiful. I think that's the most beautiful techniques in the statistical physics which were developed, and they found their natural home in the Hopfield model, because it turned out that they actually cannot be applied to any real physical systems, and the neural networks was found to be the only real system where they are actually naturally can be applied, and all the assumptions which are made there are actually satisfied much more to a much better degree in neural networks than in any physical systems for which they were actually applied. So the beauty and potentially maybe the relevance for the future and some historical significance, all this, that's the reason I decided to give this lecture, although it's a pretty risky thing because technically it's still not very easy to explain with a chalk. So just please stop me if you feel that I'm going too far away and I lose you. I wouldn't like to lose you at the beginning of the lecture for sure. So don't let me forget about the audience. Okay, so the Hopfield model. Now, what's the problem which the Hopfield model is supposed to solve? It's supposed to solve the problem of memory. Memories are clearly very important, right? In our everyday life and in our identities, individuals, memory is almost everything. If you sort of think about it in general terms, there is no life without memory. Now, people who study memory, they found that it's extremely complicated phenomena. It's not one phenomenon, it's many, many different phenomena. So we have to focus a little bit on some aspects of memory. So they distinguish a lot of types of memories. And I'm not going to give the review or the whole list of the types of memories which people who studied professionally distinguish, but just on the intuitive basis, it's clear that there are different types of memory. For example, you can classify memories as being explicit or implicit. What's explicit memory? For example, you all know very well your name, so if asked, you can easily just pronounce your name. This is sort of explicit memory, you can clearly just pronounce. So it's sometimes called declarative memory. This is a memory of isolated items which can be easily retrieved and sort of pronounced out, sort of shared with the world. Now this, but there are other types of memories which are not explicit and which are very difficult to sort of pronounce. For example, all the memories of skills, all the skills are of this nature. The clearest example for me is if you play piano, you can remember very long pieces of music. So if you just come to the piano, you can start playing and it will just follow naturally. But if you will be asked to list the sequence of notes, you will not be able to do it. And there are even more implicit types of memories which cannot be really explained. What is it that you remember? So the skills are a typical example of this implicit memories, which we will not be dealing here. So I will only deal, the Hopfield model deals with the explicit types of memory, memory of some explicit items, which can be stored and then memorized and then recalled. Another classification relates to the time scale. There are clearly memories which are very, very long term on the time of the lifespan of the individual. So, for example, we have some, we know the words, and some of them we don't use for many, many years, but we still can effortlessly retrieve them if needed. There are other types of memory which are more like of the working nature. They're called working memory. These are memories which are involved in the sort of on the time scales of the second. Like the, one of the examples is the visual memory. When you look at the scene, you remember it for a few seconds, and then if you move your eyes, sort of the gaze to another location, in order to integrate, to make sense of the whole scenery, you have to remember these images for at least a fraction of a second in order to not to experience the world as completely new every time you move your gaze. So this is a memory which operates all the time continuously, at least in this example of the vision. And this is also the type of the memory which is most easily can be studied experimentally, for example, in the monkeys. You can show the pictures to the monkeys and then you can require the monkey to remember it for some time to perform a certain task, for example, to match it to another picture which is shown later. And the monkey has to remember the picture for some interval, which is usually on the order of seconds, in order to perform the task. So this is this some working type of memory of explicit items, which the Hopfield model deals about. And you can see that it's not doesn't cover the whole memory, but it still covers a very important aspect of the memory, this ability to memorize some things, some items, and keep them in the active memory stage for for some short period of times of a second. So the question is how the brain can do it. How can you remember something which is not there anymore? Like if you look at the picture and then you close your eyes or you move your gaze, how do you remember what did you see for a few seconds if there is no stimulus which comes to your eye, which tells you this, which gives you this, provides you this information? And again, you could think about different possibilities. So there should be some memory trace left in the brain which should survive for some time. And a priori, it's not clear where this trace could reside. So it could change something in the structure of the brain, could change the neurons, some excitability of the neurons, could change the synapses. And indeed, there are these processes unknown of very fast changes in the neuronal structure, which occur very quickly after by stimulation. So this could be one mechanism of the memory. For example, very fast modification of the synapses, which happen all the time during your like viewing, for example. But another idea would be that when the stimulus which you want to memorize arises, it activates a certain pattern of activity in the brain, and then this pattern of activity can somehow survive the removal of the input. Okay, so this would not require any real modification in the system. It would just require the ability to maintain or sustain some patterns of activity for a certain time without the cause which led to them. Right? So for example, if you're talking about the visual images, every image activates a particular groups of neurons in a particular pattern. And if the visual system can carry this activity pattern for some time without the image which caused it, then you can say that this mechanism could be this could be a memory. The working memory could be served by this mechanism, because as long as this activity pattern would not decay, you can say that the brain would just know what the pattern was, even if the actual image which evoked the pattern is already gone. And indeed, I'll show you that this idea has some experimental support. Maybe you heard about this widespread effects of persistent activities which are observed in many parts of the brain. So indeed, people found the neurons which could fire with some elevated rates without the stimulus which caused it. Okay, so now, so if you take this idea that some of the activity patterns can be sustained without the stimulus, so you have to think about how this can be done with the neuronal networks. And the Hopfield model is actually a proposal, which Hopfield was not actually the first who had this idea, but I'll call the Hopfield model this whole family of networks which possess this quality of sustaining the activity pattern. So let's consider the network. And we want this network to serve as the memory. So we want that it can carry some activity patterns by itself. Now, first thing which is clear is that this has to be recurrently connected network, right? Because the feed-forward networks, which Sebastian talked about yesterday, they are completely controlled by the stimulus. I mean, they're controlled by the input. They respond to the input, but when the input is gone, all the activity in the network stops. So it has to be a recurrent network, because recurrent network is characterized by the fact that neurons provide input to each other. So they can. So if you have neurons here, let's denote sigma I, the activity of neuron I, and you say that they're all connected. Let's denote jij is the connection between neuron j to neuron I. Then what happens is that all the neurons provide input to each other. And so this changes very dramatically the nature of the network. So from the sort of input-output device, which takes the inputs and provides a certain output, it becomes a dynamical system. In other words, it becomes a system which has a dynamics of its own. And so it's much less controlled by the inputs. In general, it can have a very complex dynamics here, which is only to some certain extent can be controlled by the inputs, but it could have very rich dynamics on its own. Okay, so to be more concrete, let me just formulate the mathematical description of these kind of networks, and I will start with very simplified thing that was proposed by Hopfield, because he wanted a network which could be then analyzed by the techniques from the physics. So he assumed that the neurons are binary units, plus minus one, so you can think about it as being active neuron or not active neuron, and then there are connections, and at every time every neuron collects the inputs from all the other neurons which are connected to it. So it computes the input hi, which is just a linear sum of all the inputs. All right, so every input contributes to the input, every unit here, every neuron contributes to the input of a neuron I by its rate, and multiply it and weight it by the connection strength between these neurons. Okay, and then there is a linear summation here. So after this input is computed, the neuron can either remain in the same state of activity, sigma I, or it can change it. So if it's a binary unit, it can just flip from one value to another, depending on this input. It just compares the input with its threshold, and it decides whether it wants to flip to plus one state if it's bigger than threshold, or it wants to go to minus one state if it's less than threshold, independently on the current state of it. So mathematically you write it is that the sigma prime, or the new value, equals the sine function of hi minus threshold, but I just put it to zero here. So this is the dynamics of our network here. And in principle, there may be some external inputs here, or there may not be an external inputs. So this is a very simple caricature of the network dynamics. And you see that in principle, depending on the structure of the connection, this can be very complex. It could be almost anything. It could be fixed points, could be limit cycles, could be chaotic dynamics, depending on how you realize the connections. Even this simple network, and even in the absence of the input, could exhibit very complex pattern of dynamics here. Okay, now, so our goal is to make it, to construct such a network which could carry some patterns of activity in time. So it means that we wanted to have some stable activity states which would not change with time if you don't come with any perturbation. So how can you make this network, which a priori can exhibit very complex dynamical patterns, how can we make it so that it can carry some of the activity states as a fixed point without changing it in time? And it turns out that there is a very simple condition which guarantees that the network always converges to a fixed point, and this is symmetry condition. So if you prepare your network with symmetric connections, then you always have a fixed point. So not only you have a fixed point, but you can prove that no matter what state what initial condition you start with, after some number of iterations of this type, the network always converges to a fixed point, and then it will stay forever, provided there are no perturbing inputs. Now, how can you prove it? It's a very simple thing. You can construct the function of the activity state, and then you can prove that this function always goes down. And if it's limited from below, this will guarantee that eventually, when this function reaches its minimum, the network will be in the steady state. So what is this function? The function is very important, and it's called the energy function because of the analogy with physics. And this is this sum. Okay, so at any moment in time, you can compute this function, which is just the sum of these pairs of sigma I, sigma j, weighted with the strength of the connection j I j. Okay, so the function depends on t, because the sigmas depend on t. And now you can see what happens with this function if you realize this dynamic. So you start flipping the neurons one by one, and you can see that this function always goes down. Now it's very easy to see. Let's take one of the steps. So let's say we have a the spin or the spin of the neuron number one flipped. Okay, so what happened with this function h? Now, if you want to, if this is symmetric, so all I'm saying is only true if the Jij matrix is symmetric. So if this is symmetric, you can actually, the terms ij and ji are the same. So you can only keep the terms with I less than j, which makes it easier to analyze jij, sigma I, sigma j. And now, let's say you make this one flip, and you want to see how the energy function changed. So h prime will differ from h due to all of the terms which contain sigma 1 here, right? Because all you did, you just flipped one spin, one neuron here at the site 1. So h will be h. So all the terms which don't contain sigma 1 will be the same. And the change will be due to the terms which contained I equal 1. So it will be sum over j bigger than 1, j1j, sigma 1 prime minus sigma 1 times sigma j. Okay, so this is a, so I computed the change of the energy function due to one flip of a neuron. Okay, so if you continue this, so this term can be taken out of the summation. And what you are left with is sum over j, sum over j small, ji 1j times sigma j, which is the input to a neuron number 1. Right, that's how we define the inputs here. It's a jij, sigma j. So what you have is h minus sigma 1 prime minus sigma 1, the change of the neuron 1 due to the flip. And this is the input which neuron 1 receives. Okay, so now let's look at it. How do we do the flips? We just look at the input, and we align the neuron with the input. So if the input is positive, we say sigma will be plus 1. If the input is negative, we say sigma will be minus 1. Okay, so this product will always becomes 1, plus 1, right? Because no matter what the sign of the input is, we always flip the neuron so that it will look at the same direction, right? It will be positive for positive inputs, negative for negative. So this term will always be plus 1. Now this term, not plus 1, because this is an analog value, so it will be positive. Now this term can be either positive or negative. So if the neuron was already aligned with an input, this term was positive, but then you won't make any change. So in this case, if the neuron was already aligned, you don't do a flip, so the energy function didn't change. But if it was looking in the wrong direction, then you will do a flip, and then this will have an opposite sign to this. So this term then will be negative. So in this case, only in this case you do the flip. You only flip the neuron if it looks in the wrong direction. And so you see that this term is always either positive or zero, right? This whole term. So if you write it as h minus delta h, this term is either positive if you do the flip, or it's zero if you don't do the flip, right? So if you don't change the neuron, the energy function doesn't change. If you do have to do a flip, the energy function always goes down. Now you can see that it's bounded from below because it's some of the terms, all of them are finite. So it means that every time you do this one step of iteration, the energy function either stays or goes down. And this guarantees you that eventually it will reach some local minimum, after which there will be no change. Yeah. Right now, I don't have any assumptions about this matrix except that it is symmetric. So it can be any sign you want. Okay, so this, analysis is true for any possible matrix, as long as this is symmetric. Yeah. Well, I didn't say you how many minimums H may in principle has many, many minimums. So what this shows is that no matter where you start, you will reach some local minimum after which the dynamics will stop. Okay, so in principle, you may have a lot of minimums, and if you start somewhere in the vicinity of some of the local minimum or in its basin of attraction, by these dynamics, the network will go to the minimum. And then it will stay there forever. Okay, so that's what we proved now, provided that the network is symmetric. So we have it's very easy to construct the network which can carry the patterns without the input for some time by just taking the symmetric network. Now this is by itself it's not enough because we want something more. We want to control where these minimums are. Because if you just take any symmetric network, let's say a random network with symmetric connections, it's very difficult to know where these minimums will be. Even if you know Jij, what you'll have to do is you'll just have to do a lot of simulations. You have to start from all possible initial conditions, wait until the dynamics reach the fixed point, and then do it again and again and again. And this is will take you an infinite time if the network is sufficiently big. So you will not know where these minimums are. So you cannot really use it as a memory because you cannot predict. You cannot, if you, let's say, you want to recall some of the particular memories, you will not know, let's say, this one, number 100, you will not know how to do it. What input will lead to this corresponding input, to this corresponding minimum. So you want somehow a way of constructing the matrix which will provide the minimums which you can control. Okay, so that's an ESC problem.
So before you say, yeah. Can you just say a little bit about what changes if the J-matrix is not symmetric?
I cannot say anything general. So in principle, if J is not symmetric, you are not guaranteed to converge to a fixed point. So in most of the cases, if you start the dynamics, it will never stop. So the spins will, the neurons will keep flipping up and down, and the overall pattern may be very complex and be chaotic, as I said, could be limit cycles. Occasionally, it could converge to the fixed point, but this is not guaranteed. So you can't say anything general, but I will comment about all these extensions later. After I'm done with the Hopfield model, I will talk about all these limitations and assumptions, which we all dealt with later. Okay, so now, how to control the minimum? So this is nice, you have minimums, you have stable states, and you may have many of them, which is nice, because you don't want the network to remember just one thing. You want it to be able to remember many things simultaneously, but you want to control the minimums. So in particular, you can pose the problem this way. Let's say you know the patterns which you want to become a minimums. How can you construct the network to do this? So let's say I give you the pattern psi 1, which is just a collection of plus minus 1s. Psi 2 and psi p. And you want these patterns to become the minimums or these fixed points. Okay, not any other patterns, not just arbitrary collection of patterns, but you want these particular patterns to become the minimums. Okay, maybe some others, but at least you want this. Okay, for example, you want to remember a certain number. So, and if you can figure out what pattern of activity this number evokes in, let's say, in your auditory cortex when you hear it, you want this particular pattern to become the minimum. You want to remember this particular pattern. You don't want to remember just a random pattern of activity. Or if you see a picture and you know in the visual cortex how the neurons respond to this picture, you want this particular pattern to become the memory. You want to memorize this particular pattern. You don't want to go just to any arbitrary state and make this a fixed point. You want this particular pattern, which is evoked by the picture, to become the fixed point. Okay, so Hopfield came up with the idea which works under certain conditions. And the idea is very simple. All you have to do, you have to add, so you start from the connection matrix, which is 0, sort of a tabula rasa. You start with a network which is not connected, or which is connected, but all these connections are have negligible strength. And then every time you want to store the pattern, you modify these connections in a certain way. So what you do is that you add the contributions from each pattern, which are very simple. You just take the value of the pattern at the site I and multiply it by the value of the pattern at the site j. Okay? And that's it. So you just you do this multiplication. Okay? Now if you want to store another pattern, you just add another contribution. Okay? And you see, it doesn't matter now in which order you want to store them. After you store all of them, you have a matrix which is the linear sum of these contributions. It's sum from 1 to p of these products. Okay, and you may normalize it just for subsequent analysis. So this is the algorithm, very simple. Right? Now, I can comment already here that it has some motivation or some inspiration from biology, because this tells you that this has something to do with the potentiation of the synapses, which we'll discuss tomorrow. But already here you can see that this algorithm basically modifies the synapse according to the activity of pre- and postsynaptic neurons. Right? You don't have to know what other neurons in the network are doing. All you have to know is that if the neuron number I has activity psi I, and the neuron number j has activity psi j, you modify the connection by the product without having to know anything about all the other neurons in the network. So this is a local rule, and was inspired by Hopfield, by Hebb in the late 40s, who actually was the first who formulated this idea of neuronal populations being a mechanism for memory. And he had this inspiration that this can be achieved by this kind of learning rules or modification rules. We change the connection as a function of the pre- and postsynaptic activities, but without having to know all the other activities in the network. So now, the question is, why is this a good idea? Right? This is has some biological advantages because it's a local rule. So it can be presumably realized in the real synapses. The question is why it's a good idea for our purposes, why this can help you to memorize these patterns. So let's assume that you did this. So you have these patterns and you constructed this matrix. Let's see if this indeed guarantees that every pattern will be a fixed point. So assume now how to check it. You just have to prepare the network in one of these states and then see what happens. If it will stay in this state, or it will evolve away from this. So let's do this. So let's assume that you have your network in the state which coincides with one of the patterns. It's I1. And let's see what happens at the next step. So we have to compute the input to all of the neurons. So if you compute the input, it is the sum over j, jij, sigma j. Now instead of sigma j, I put this. Instead of jij, I put my formula, the Hopfield algorithm here. So what I have is 1 over n, sum over mu, ij psi I mu psi j mu, and instead of sigma I put psi 1. Okay, so this will be the input which any neuron in the network receives at the first instance. Okay, so now I can divide this sum into two terms. In one term mu equal to 1, and and all the rest I combine with at the second term. So the term is mu equal 1 will be the following. So you will have psi I1 Here it will be 1 over n. Sorry, there is no sum over I here. 1 over n psi j 1 squared. Now, my patterns are binary elements, plus minus 1. So if you square, then you get 1. So this sum reduces to 1. Plus, you have all the other terms with mu which are not equal to 1. So it's 1 over n, sum mu which are not equal to 1, sum over j, psi j, mu, psi j, 1. Okay, let me put 1 over n here. So what is this? This is a scalar product of different patterns here, right? Pattern number 1, this pattern number 2, 3, etc. to p. So let's denote it as m mu 1. This is a scalar product of the patterns, or overlap. This tells you how closely the patterns overlap. So that's what you are, and there will be psi I mu here, which I left over. Okay, so what you are ended up with is psi I 1 plus sum over all other patterns, psi I mu, and this all other patterns weighted by their overlap with the first one. Okay, so you see there are two terms here. One is the good term, because if this was the only term, you would see that the input to the neuron it coincides again with the pattern. So it means that if you start with the pattern psi I1, if this were the dominant contribution, at the next step you wouldn't have to flip any of the neurons, right? They would be already in the right state, because you start them as psi I1, and this is the input which they get, and they always have the same sign. So you wouldn't have to flip any of the spin. This would be the fixed point. Now these terms are the interference terms, right? Due to the fact that there are other patterns there, they can corrupt it. So they can, if they are sufficiently big, and here the big means bigger than 1, they can change the sign of the input and say, then you will have to flip the neuron. And you don't want this, because you want this state to be a stable state. But you see that if the patterns are not very overlapped, let's say if they are independent somehow, that these scalar products are small, and if there are not so many patterns, you can see that this term will be small, and so this term will dominate, and each of the patterns will be a fixed point. Okay, so it is clear. This is like a real punchline of the Hopfield model. So if you don't appreciate this, there's no really logic in going forward.
Explain once more why that's small.
This may be small, may be big. I'm just saying that it may be small because this is a scalar product of different patterns. And let's say you create them independently. Let's say they are not correlated. So this term will be, on general, for a big network, it will be something like 1 over square root of n. Right? And so if there are not so many terms like this, this term will be small. So there are some, and I will elaborate on this later, but there are some reasonable conditions under which this term will dominate. Right, exactly. This term determines how many memories you can put in the network. This is all issue of the capacity, which I will deal with a little bit later. But if this is not a problem, then you have a system which has this property which you wanted, that all the pattern psi I are the fixed points. Right? You check it for pattern 1, but since all of them are equivalent, you can start from any other patterns and you'll see that all of them will be fixed points. So what you did is that you created the network which has the minimums at exactly the locations you want, right? So this will be psi 1, psi 2, psi 3, and up to psi p. All of these states will exactly be the minimums of the energy function. So it means that if the network starts from this state, it will not move away, right? So it can be, these activity states can be carried for some time by the network because they are local minimums of the energy. And of course here, since everything is symmetric, they have exactly the same value of the energy because they're all equivalent. Again, this doesn't guarantee that there are no other local minimum. There may be other local minimum, but at least these particular patterns are the local minimums. Now, if you think a little bit about it, we actually have more than just this. So, as I said, now, if you start from the pattern, the network will stay there. Yeah. It could be maximum, yeah, but you can show. It's very easy to show that this because in each of these states the value of this the neuron is aligned with an input, so it means that all these energy terms are positive, negative, and so this is actually a minimum. You are right. I mean, you can show that this is actually a stable fixed point. Could be like this, then it would be unstable. Yeah. Well, that's what I said. You don't know. There are other minimums, right? So there may be other minimums. There may be many of them. Okay, but this may not be so bad. After all, all you wanted is that these patterns were minimums. Now, but I am just trying to tell you now that you actually have more than just this, because if the minimums are separated by sufficiently big barriers here, you have the whole region of the state space, which are called the basin of attraction, so that if your initial conditions are within this basin, the network will converge to the minimum by itself. Right? So what does it mean? It's a very attractive property, because you can say now, in order to retrieve the memory, you don't have to provide all the details you have. Right? You don't have to prepare the network exactly at the state of psi. You can put some errors there. Let's say you randomly flip some neurons, or you don't remember something. Let's say you want to recall the phone number, but you don't remember all the digits. Let's say you forgot the first and the last, or you forgot something in the middle. So you provide the network with the initial condition, which should be sufficiently close to the right memory, and then it will correct the errors and it will converge to the minimum, right? Because this is the minimum. We know that due to the dynamics, the energy function has to go down. And so if you are in the basin of attraction of the minimum, the energy will go down until the network reaches this steady state. So you earned this property almost by free. You didn't do anything. All you wanted was to prepare the network so that it has a given fixed points. But the additional benefit which you have here is that it can correct the errors. It can retrieve the information based on just some partial cues. Okay, let me show you just how it can work. If you have some demonstration, not real demonstration, not like Sebastian type demonstration, but log-tech. This? So that's a simple toy example just to illustrate the main ideas. So you take a network and you prepare the patterns. Now, as you see, there is no actual meaning here of where the neuron is located, because all of the neurons are connected. So just to guide your eye, you can prepare the patterns which have some particular geometric shapes. And it could be, so you say, if the neuron is +1, you put a black pixel there, otherwise you put a white pixel, and you can create any shapes here. So you prepare 10 patterns. And I took this from a recent review of Tom Kulin, a recent review on the statistical physics of the Hopfield models. Okay, so this is the patterns which you prepare, and then you take a Hopfield network and you store them according to the algorithm which I described. Okay, so now you know, or you hope, that these patterns are actually the minimums of the energy. So if you prepare the network in this pattern, they will be stable. They will not move. But you can see more than that. You can now prepare the network in a corrupted version of this pattern. So you take one of the patterns, let's say this phase, and you put a noise into it. So you just randomly may introduce the error. So you flip the black pixels into white and the white pixels into black, and you see what happens. Then you run the dynamics and you see what happens. And so that's what you see here. So you put a lot of noise here, And then you just follow the dynamics, and you see after a few iterations per each synapse, the network corrected all the noise. Right? It sounds like, almost looks like a miracle. Now, how does the network know which pixels are noise and which pixels are signal? But it knows because in the connection matrix, when you were making the connection matrix, you used the true patterns. So you take these patterns and they use them to create the matrix. Okay? And since these patterns were used to create the matrix, they become the fixed points. And if you prepare this pattern, which looks completely random and you cannot really identify that it was a phase, but it's apparently close enough to the phase to be in the basin of attraction. So if you just run the network by itself without any help, this recovers the full phase. Right, you could choose any pattern. That's true. If you put too much noise, eventually you go outside of the basin of attraction. So you will then move into some other minimum, which could be another pattern, could be some other state, because we said we don't know how many minimums you have. But there is some tolerance level here, and then you see that in this case it's pretty impressive because you create a lot of noise. It still keeps the network in the basin of attraction of the face.
Yeah. On the other hand, you can completely know the pattern.
Right. That's what you see here. Right. That's what you see here. No, okay. You are right. You pointed to a real problem, but that's exactly what they did here. So here you create the completely noisy pattern, and then you see we know that any initial condition evolves into a fixed point because this is a symmetric network. But you see that the fixed point which you reach here doesn't coincide with any of the patterns, right? So this shows. It's an answer to the question. This proves that in this network there are other minimums, which are very different from the minimums, from the patterns which you use to create the network, right? And so if you start from the noisy pattern, you will converge to one of these, sometimes they're called spurious or parasitic minimums, which you didn't want to be in the network, but they just, they are there against your wish, if you say. Now, you are right that this creates the problem, because the network cannot tell you which of the inputs actually correspond to one of the memories and which not. It will always provide you with an answer, and because you prove that any initial condition will lead to some minimum, the network takes any input as any initial pattern of activity as an input, it will always provide you with some fixed point, and cannot distinguish between the true fixed point, true memories like this one, and the spurious memories like this one. So that's one of the problems of the Hopfield model. No, this will be a completely different pattern of this language. Right? The network doesn't know anything about invariances here. If you rotate the image, all the pixels will have different values. So in terms of all the network knows is basically this overlaps, how close you are in terms of the scalar product. So there is no invariance here. Yeah, that's what I said. This is just to guide the eyes. It's just to illustrate how the network dynamics can correct the errors. But it's a bit more than that, because this tells you how wide the basin of attraction can be, right? You can actually create it. If you this graph here shows the overlap of the state with each of the memories. So, for example, the overlap of this state with the first memory was pretty low. It was about 0.1. So you introduced like 90% of errors, right? 90% of the pixels were in error. Only 10% of the pixels carried information, and this was enough to retrieve the full pattern. So it means that under some condition, this network can be extremely robust and extremely capable of correcting the errors, but not under all the conditions.
Can you get down to the number of experiments?
That's a final result of the analysis which I will arrive. You can give some estimates and... In error, yeah. You just introduced a lot of random, but they have to be random errors. That's a whole trick. Yeah.
So, it's not that, like, because randomly you expect it to be correct. So, you're saying that
Right, you take the pattern, then you keep the 10% of the pixels intact, and then the 90% you randomly flip.
So some of the 90% will stay correct.
Say it again?
One thing, if you randomly flip the whole image, eventually you'll expect half the image.
If you randomly flip all the image, you get to this situation. Right. But if you keep at least some fraction of the pixels at the right values, then this may be enough for you to retrieve the whole picture. Okay. I couldn't hear you. Which images? Negative, yeah. Yeah, actually you can show, since the energy function is symmetric, if you flip all the neurons, you will get the same energy. So if you have a minimum, if you just replace black to white and white to black, you would still get a minimum. That's some artificial property of the Hopfield model, which is due to all these assumptions, which were really not meant to describe the real biological networks, but just to make the analysis simpler. So we will talk about all these artificial assumptions after I'm done with the analysis of the Hopfield model. All right. So this was the easy part. And now I want to tell you, so this still was sort of had some flavor of physics, but it's not clear why do you need physics to analyze this. So the questions which were actually raised here is how well this network works under many different conditions, how many memories you can store, what are the limits on the memories? I told you that they should be somehow non-overlapped or random in order to for the system to work best. Now, what are precisely the conditions for the network to work? So all these issues were analyzed, and it turns out that you can apply the statistical physics to this. So let me now give you some review of the statistical physics methods. And the relevant piece of statistical physics is the statistical mechanics of magnetic systems. So this is the way it's formulated is exactly the way people model the magnetic systems. Okay, so let's forget about memories for a moment. And let's try to be physicists now. And let's say that you are interested in the properties of some magnetic materials. Right? So you want to study their magnetization, their behavior in the magnetic field, and things like this, which is not less exciting, I think, than the memories. So you have a magnetic system. Let's say you have a systems of magnetic spins in a crystal which occupy so you have some magnetic atoms which occupy certain locations in the crystal, and under some conditions this magnetic spins can only look in two directions. They can be either looking upwards or downwards. So this is called Ising spins. It can be either plus or minus one. And they interact via magnetic forces. So there are many possible kinds of interactions, but they can be broadly classified into being either ferromagnetic interactions or antiferromagnetic interactions. So ferromagnetic interactions are the interactions which prefer the two spins to look in the same direction, right? So the energy becomes minimum if they look at the same direction. Otherwise, if the interaction prefers them to look at the opposite direction, this is called antiferromagnetic interaction. Okay, so any pair of spins interacts by the value Jij, and the energy of the system is given by this sum. Right? This is a pairwise interaction, then you have to go over all pairs and sum it up. Okay, so the simplest system is the ferromagnet, as I said, where all Jijs are positive. Let's take first this case, because it looks like it's a simple case. Because then the most preferred state will be when all spins look in the same direction. So they either look up or they down, and so the whole system will have a net magnetic moment, which is non-zero, at least at very low temperatures. The temperatures become higher, the temperature creates a disorder here, so it can break this order, and the magnetic moment can disappear. So the main issue in the analysis of magnetic system here is to compute how the magnetic moment behaves as a function of the temperature. At what temperatures it disappears, for example, how it reacts to external magnetic fields, and so on. So how is it dealt with in statistical physics? There is just one basically formula which you have to know in order to solve all of these systems, and this is called the Boltzmann distribution. So the statistical physics doesn't deal with precise microscopic dynamics of these spins, as we wrote before. It deals with the probabilities. And why is it dealing with probabilities? Because, or in other words, what creates the randomness is the fact that you have a finite temperature here. So the system lives in a crystal, let's say, which serves as a thermal bath, and it creates a lot of random flippings here. So it does make sense to try to follow the precise dynamics of these flippings, of the spins up and down. All you can do is to describe the probabilities for the whole system to be in a particular state. And the Boltzmann distribution gives you precisely this description. It tells you that the probability to find the system in a particular state is only a function of the energy of this state. So the probability that all spins are in a particular state is given by e to minus beta h of sigma with some normalization. And the parameter beta here relates to the temperature. It's 1 over the temperature. Okay, so if the temperature is very low, only the states with the minimal energy have a finite probability. So for example, if the temperature is 0, beta is infinity, so this term becomes very negative if the energy increases. So the only state which will be realized is the state of the minimum energy. And in the case of the ferromagnetic interaction, this will be either all the spins looking up, all the spins looking down. But if the temperature grows, you have a finite probability to find the state in some other states, like this one, where some of the spins are flipped. And the question is, what will be the average magnetization for a given value of the temperature? It turns out that you can answer all of this question if you compute this normalization factor here. This normalization factor is called the statistical sum. It's introduced here to normalize the probability, so that if you sum over all possible configurations, you have to sum it to 1. So it means that zeta is given by the sum of all configurations of e to minus beta h of sigma. Okay, so this is very clear. You just have a normalization factor. And if you compute it, if you put it here, these probabilities will be normalized. It turns out that if you know how to compute this function, you solve the whole statistical mechanics of this problem. Because if you know this statistical sum, if you take the log of this, you will compute the free energy, 1 minus beta. And if you know the free energy, you can, by differentiating it, let's say you add here some auxiliary magnetic field, if you differentiate it df over dh, it will give you the average value of the spin, for example. Or if you differentiate it over the value of jij, you can have a correlation. And this is very easy to check by just having this formula. So you can take it as an exercise. It's really a very simple exercise to show That if you know the free energy of the system, you solve the statistical mechanics. Because by differentiating it by over the fields, you can find the magnetization, for example. Okay, so all the statistical physics is reduced basically to computing this function for a particular system. So how to compute this function? It turns out that it's not an easy task. Even in the very simplest models, to compute it exactly is not easy. So what's the simplest model which people dealt with is, for example, the situation where all the connections are the same for neighbors and zero otherwise. So let's say every spin only interacts with its immediate neighbors. Okay, the simplest situation and has some relevance to physics. And even in this case, to solve exactly the problem is very difficult. It was solved only in two dimensions, let's say, but was not solved in three dimensions. So to analytically calculate these functions, the statistical sum of the free energy, is very difficult even in the very simplest situation. Right? So that's a whole field of statistical physics which tried to develop the methods of analytical calculations. It's a very difficult, mathematically very difficult calculations. And the problem is that they don't give you an insight about some general properties of this system. You can solve some particular examples, but it's not clear how can you generalize it to other systems. Now, there is a trick which allows you to do approximate calculations, which is not very relevant for physics, but as I said, are much more relevant for neural networks. It's called mean field. So let me explain what is mean field. Turns out that this is very relevant for neural networks. The mean field approximation becomes accurate if you have another extreme. Instead of saying that the spins only interact with the neighbors, let's say that they interact with a lot of other spins. So the range of interactions is very big. Right? It's not in physics, it's hard to imagine how this could be done, but in the neural networks, it's actually a very, very reasonable approximation because you know that any neuron in the cortex interacts with many, many other neurons. And some of the connections go actually very far. So this approximation is relevant here. So this makes the problem much easier. Why is it making the problem much easier? Because now if you compute the magnetic field or the input which each spin has from others, so let's compute Hi, which is sum over Jij sigma j. And let's take another extreme where all of the interactions are the same and they are equal j. So it's 1 over j over n sigma j. Okay, so this is another extreme where the interaction strength doesn't depend on the distance between the spins. All of the spins interact with each other with the same strength. So what you have here, any of these spins are randomly fluctuating up and down because of the temperature. But what you have here is a big sum of them, a big number of them. And this gives you the average magnetization. So if you have many spins, even if they fluctuate, each of them fluctuates randomly, the average magnetization should be constant, right, because of the law of the large numbers. So it means that the field of any neuron, any spin experiences here, is a deterministic number, right? It doesn't fluctuate, it almost doesn't fluctuate. It's given by J times N. Okay, so now instead of solving the problem of many interacting spins, all you have to do is to solve the problem of one spin, which is influenced by the magnetic field, which is constant, doesn't change with time. This is a very easy problem because we know that if this is the magnetic field of one spin, its energy is minus sigma times H. This is the energy of one spin. Right? It's positive if the spin looks in the direction of the field, and it's negative in the other case. So you can easily find the probability of the spin being either plus or minus 1 equals e to minus sigma H normalized, right? It can be either plus one or minus one. So to normalize it, you have to. This will be the probability of the spin. And so you compute the average value of this spin. Sum over sigma equals plus minus 1. Sigma times this probability. E to minus sigma h. E to minus h plus e to minus h. Okay, this is plus minus 1. So it equals e to minus. Sorry, this is plus, yeah, because this is energy and P is E to minus energy. So equals E to H minus E to minus H. E to H plus E to minus H. And this is called hyperbolic. And there is a beta everywhere here. This is called hyperbolic tangents of beta h. Hyperbolic tangent, yeah. I will throw mistakes from time to time just to check if you are awake. Okay, so if you know the field, and you know the field, it's given by Jm. So it's tangents hyperbolic beta Jm. So if you knew the magnetization, you would know the field, and then you know the average magnetic moment of the spin. Now this has to be also self-consistent, right? This average magnetic field of the average magnetic moment of the spin has to coincide with average magnetization of the whole system, because you just picked up the random spin in the system. So its average should coincide with the overall energy, average. So this should be M again, right? This is a very important point. This is the whole idea of the mean field. You just compute things self-consistently. You assume that there is some average magnetization, then you compute the magnetization of each spin, and you say this has to coincide. These two things have to coincide, otherwise you will not have a self-consistent solution. Okay, so this gives you directly the equation. If you solve it, you will find the magnetization of the system as a function of the temperature and the connection and the strength of interaction. Okay, so you reduce this very difficult problem of solving the statistical mechanics of interacting system of the spins. So you reduce it to just one equation if all you're interested in is the average magnetization. And this is a relevant quantity you are interested in. So how you can now solve it by plotting some pictures. So you plot the function, this function hyperbolic tangents. It has this shape. This is M, and this has to be equal to M. And now you see that there are several situations here. It could be, everything depends on the slope of this function at zero. Is the slope of this function at zero is less than one, then the only intersection point will be at zero. Okay? And this happens if beta J is bigger than one. So if the temperature is sufficiently big, so T bigger than J, the average magnetization will be zero. The temperature is big enough to break the order. And so although the spins want to look in one direction, if the temperature is high enough, it breaks this the natural tendency, and the average magnetization will be zero. So on the average, there will be the equal number of spins looking up and equal number of spins of looking down. Now, if the T is less than J, you can figure it out that the slope here at zero will be bigger than one. So then what you'll have is, you'll have the following graph. And you see that there are three intersection points. So in addition to this intersection point at zero, you have two more. Now, of course, you have two because you have a symmetric problem. So for any positive magnetization, you have a negative magnetization. Now, the question is which one has a physical meaning, right? Or maybe both of them have a physical meaning. Now, I will show you a little bit later that this fixed point is unstable and this fixed point is a stable. So in this situation you have a finite magnetization. So for low temperatures which are below the J, the system will have a finite magnetization. And if you figure out, so there is a transition, phase transition, from low to high temperatures where the magnetization disappears. So if you plot, if you solve this equation, and if you plot the magnetization as a function of temperature, you'll see this is a critical temperature, which equals J in this case. So above it, magnetization is zero. At zero temperature, it is one, because at zero temperature, all the spins deterministically look in one direction, or minus one, or plus minus one. And then there is a line here. And you can find out exactly what happens in the transition point. So you can find that magnetic moment is proportional to square root of Tc minus T here. So you solve the problem completely, but this is a mean field approximation. So you don't know if this behavior will also happen in the real system where the interactions are not infinitely long range. But if the interactions are all to all, this will be the behavior. Okay, so how we do with the break? I have to finish at 12, right?
No, you can finish at 12:30.
12:13. Well, maybe I'll give you one more piece of statistical physics. So this is sort of was ad hoc solution, right? It was not real solution. I didn't show you how to compute the free energy. I just said that you can write self-consistency equation and you can write directly the equation for the magnetization. But for example, this doesn't tell you which solutions are stable. You have to believe me that this solution is unstable and these two are stable. Now, how to show that this is indeed the case? For this, you have to compute the free energy and see if this is indeed the minimums and this is not. And this is also possible in the mean field approximation. So let me just give you one. I'm going up and up the hill, so this will be almost the most difficult part technically. The second difficult part is how to compute the free energy in the mean field approximation, and then we go back to Hopfield model after the break. Okay, so let's remember this equation, because this is a true equation, but let me show you how can you do things a little bit more rigorously. Again, mean field approximation, but how to compute the free energy. So you have Jij equals J over N. All the spins interact with the same thing. So the energy, which is 1/2 Jij sigma I sigma j, if you plug it in here, you have minus j over 2 sum over ij sigma I sigma j. So this can be written, if you ignore the fact that there is no self-interaction, this can be written as minus j n over 2 1 over n sum over I sigma I squared. Okay, so this is an average magnetization, so you can write it as minus Jn over 2m of sigma squared. Okay, so the energy of the configuration depends only on the average magnetization of this state, right? All the states which have the same magnetization will have exactly the same energy. It's just the definition of the magnetization. So now what we have to do, we have to compute the free energy, which is the log of the statistical sum, and the statistical sum of the sum of all configurations of e to minus beta h. So it equals 1 minus beta log sum of us all spin configurations, which are 2 to n, e to beta j n over 2 m square of sigma. Okay, now there is a first trick. You see, you have to sum over all possible spin configurations, and there are many of them, 2 to n. But you see that the energy depends only on the magnetization. So all the configurations which have the same magnetization, they contribute with exactly the same term here. So it's natural to break this sum into two steps. First, you pick a particular magnetization and sum over all possible spin configurations which have this magnetization. This will be trivial because they all have the same contribution. And then you have to make a sum over all possible magnetizations. Okay, so I just break it into two. I first sum over all possible magnetizations, and magnetization can be anything from minus 1 to 1. So I say minus beta log, here I integrate from minus 1 to 1 dm. So all of the states which have this magnetization will have exactly the same contribution. Okay? But now there may be different number of states which produce the given magnetization. So for example, if magnetization is zero, it means that half of the spins looking up and half of the spins looking down, there are many states like this. But if you take magnetization which is one, this can be only realized in one case when all of the spins look up. So for any value of the magnetization, there is a density or number of states which have this particular magnetization. Right? So this is very big, let's say, for zero, and this is just one for plus minus one. Okay, so this is an exact transformation, but you have to compute what's d of m. How many states have a particular magnetization m? Now, you can either compute it. This is just a combinatorical problem, right? You just have to count how many states produce the number of spins up, which is m. Or you can use another trick, which I also want to show you, to compute it if you have a very big system. So in the very big system, so what is d of m? D of m is the number of configurations for which the magnetization equals m. So you can write it as a sum over all configurations, delta functions of m minus 1 over n, sum over I sigma I, right? This is just a definition. You have to sum all of the configurations of spins for which the magnetization equals m, right? So this delta function will make it for you. It will only take the contributions from the spin configurations which have the true value of the magnetization. Now, this can be, delta function has a nice integral representation. E to ix m dx. So we can put it here. So it equals sigma, sum over sigma, integral dx from minus to plus infinity e to ix m 1 minus 1 over n sum over I sigma I. So what did we gain here? Now we had a problem, a difficult problem, because we had interactions here. So it was not clear how to compute the sum of all possible configurations, because you have these products of sigma I, sigma j. But now we have any sigma entering just once. There is no term sigma I, sigma j. And so now it's very easy to compute the sum over sigmas, right? Because you can do it for each I independently. So you can continue. You can say it's dx e to ixm. And let's introduce n here, just to cancel this one. It will just add an extra constant here. So I put n here. And here you have to sum over sigmas this exponent. But this is a product of terms for each I independently. So you can sum, make the summation for every site independently. Sum over sigma I equals plus minus 1. So this is where the mean field enters. As you remember, instead of solving the problem for the whole system, we have to find the statistical sum for only one side here. And here it will be e to I x minus sigma I. Now, what is this? Sigma I equals plus minus 1. So what you have here is e to minus I x plus e to I x. This is nothing but 2 cosinus of x, right? So you have integral dx e to n times I times x times m. And here it will be 2 cosinus x to the power of n. Okay, n is the number of sides, the size of the system. Or this you can write as e to n log 2 cosinus x. Okay, so this is your density state. So for a given magnetization, this is how many states you have which have this magnetization. So you can now go back to our equation and continue. And what you have is minus 1 over beta log integral dm from minus 1 to 1 integral dx from minus infinity to infinity. And here you have exponent. All of the terms which I have here have a common factor n, which I take out. And what I am left with is beta j over 2 m square plus I x m plus log 2 cosinus x. Okay, so let's denote this f small, which depends on f, m, and x. So you see there is an integral of a function which is multiplied by n. Now, n is very big. We are talking about the very big system, macroscopic system. So the integral has to be determined by the extremums of this function, by the minimums, by the maximums, right? If this function, you have to check it, but if this function has a maximum at particular values of m and x, then this integral will be determined by this maximum. So it will be approximately, all this integral will be approximately e to n times maximum value of this function. So there will be some values of m and x which will make the function maximum, and all this integral will be given by the extremum of this function. I know. I'm just giving you some. Okay, now if this is true, then the log will be given by just this function. So if you find the extremums, then the function f will be n times the extremum value of this function m and x. Okay, so it means that it's clear. Okay, so it's reasonable that it's proportional to n because you have a macroscopic system, so the free energy will be proportional to n, and it will be given by the extremums of this function. So now you have to see exactly where the extremums of this function are, and if you can find them and you can solve the problem of complexity which Sebastian mentioned, then you know the free energy, right? This is approximation, which is true for very big n. So for macroscopic systems, you can compute the free energy by this trick. So now you have to look at the extremums of this function. So to look for the extremums, you have to take derivatives. So let's first take the derivative over m, because that's easier. So if you take df over dm, what you find is, so you have ix plus beta j square m equals 0. Right, so x equals I beta j square m. So if you now eliminate x, put it here, you get a function which now depends only on the m. These are all shortcuts, which can be all justified. No. Ah, it's minus, but then another I. So it will be. Okay. So now you eliminate x, you just put it here. And then you are left with just magnetization, because magnetization is the physical quantity, and the x was just some auxiliary value which you introduced to compute the density. So what you have is minus beta j over 2 m squared plus log 2 cos of I beta j squared m. Now, the cosinus of I something is minus hyperbolic cosinus of the same thing. So what you have here, no, it's just a hyperbolic cosinus. So what you have is this expression. Excuse me? No, this was just a normal cosine, because there was I here. But if you put x equal I something, then you have exactly e to the hyperbolic cosine. OK, so this is the free energy. And I didn't look carefully at all the issues that x was imaginary. So you have to see exactly how this integral in the complex plane is taken. But you can actually deal with all this. Now, if you take the minimum of this, you get back the equation for the magnetization. Mm-hmm. Okay, m equals tan. So this is consistent with this. But it can actually tell you but it also gives you the shape of the free energy, right? This is now the free energy as a function of the magnetization. And we understand that the true free energy is given by the minimum of this. So let's see how this free energy looks as a function of magnetization. So you can plot it. Can you see what I plot here? Again, it depends on the on this parameter beta j. So you can find out that if beta j is bigger than is less than 1, which means that t is bigger than j, this free energy has one minimum at 0. Okay, so the extremum of this function will be given by the value of m, which is 0 here.
Sorry, just
the
back
equation.
Where does the j squared come from?
I thought it was like j squared. Maybe I did some mistake. Let me see. There's actually no j squared. So somewhere I put, let me see if I can track it. There is no j square. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So for high temperatures, this is how the free energy. So this is not a true free energy. As I said, the true free energy is given by the minimum of this. So this is how this function f at m looks, and the true free energy will then be given by the value of this at 0 m. So the true value of m will be 0. But for low temperatures, which are less than j, this function looks different. It looks like this. So this is t bigger than j. This is t less than j. So you can figure it out from this expression. Right. Right.
And the
other thing is the fluctuation.
So it should be like 1 over m or something. Big, the m squared. It's a fluctuation curve.
No, this is all.
It should scale out with the
direction. Yeah, but this is because I scaled the interactions in 1 over n. That's what provided the true. If I didn't scale the interactions with 1 over n, this limit would not exist. But I scaled it with 1 over n, so that's why in the limit you have a finite contributions from both of these terms. Okay, so now what's the meaning of this graph? This is a very important graph because it says that the free energy now breaks into two minimums, right? You have one minimum for minus m0 and another one for plus m0. So in the physical language, it means that the ergodicity here is broken. You have two energy minimums which are separated by a large barrier, because remember that the free energy here equals n times this. So this barrier, in terms of the real free energy, is on the order of n. I mean that if the system is in the domain of the positive magnetization, it will never, or it will take an infinite time to go to the state with the negative magnetization, although these have the same energy, right? So these two states, in terms of the energy, they're equivalent. But if you prepare the system with the positive magnetization, it will never go to the negative magnetization. So the ergodicity is broken. The ergodicity tells you that all of the states which have the same energy should have the same probability to occur. So if you wait long enough, the ergodicity principle tells you that all of the states which have the same energy should be visited on the average the same number of times by the system. But here it doesn't happen. If the system is big enough, the ergodicity is broken. It's broken into two parts. So sometimes they say there are two ergodicity domains here. Within this, it's still ergodic. So all of the states of the same energy have the same probability also here, but there are no flips from one to another. From one domain to another, it's like the system divided its space into two domains and it doesn't go from one to another. And the barrier scale is like n, because as I said, the true free energy is given by n times this small f, right? So the barriers between these minimums is, in terms of the true free energy, is n. That's why the time to go from one to another diverges if you have a big system. Okay, so you can say this is a memory, right? In the physical term, this is a memory. If the system is in the positive domain, where the magnetization is a positive, it will never go to the negative, never equilibrize. So for the low temperature, the system has a memory, in our language. And that's how you can see what happens, that this state is not stable, right? So for low temperatures, although there is an extremum here of the free energy, which corresponds to this intersection point, but you see that it's actually a maximum of the free energy, not the minimum, so the system cannot stay here for some time. This is a normal ferromagnet. It's just a ferromagnet, normal ferromagnet with infinitely long interactions.
Yes, but we also have.
Yeah, you're right. The phase transition occurs. You don't need the mean field approximation to have a phase transition. You have a phase transition even in the systems with the short range interaction. So the same phenomena occurs also in the real ferromagnet, if that's what you mean. I'm just, this approximation just allowed us to compute the free energy, right? You cannot do it in a general case unless you are in a very special situation, like a two-dimensional Ising spin system where you can compute it analytically. But otherwise, the mean field approximation gives you a good tool to estimate the free energy and to completely understand what's going on in the system in terms of the temperature and the strength of interaction. Okay, so we are almost done with the physics. Now, after the break, we can go back to the Hopfield model and see how the same formalism can be applied to analysis of the memories in the Hopfield model. Okay, so I have one more technical piece here about the Hopfield model. So we go back from the magnetic systems to Hopfield model,
And I'll show you how can you apply the same tool or the same technique to compute the equation for the performance of the Hopkins model in the memory. Just one comment, somebody asked me here during the break. So here we introduced the temperature, and the temperature was the main factor here, right? Because for high temperatures there was no ergodicity breaking, so the system had just one ergodic domain, and for low temperature there was this ergodicity breaking. Now, what is the analog of the temperature in the neural network? There is no, it's clearly not the temperature of the brain. So you can think about it in two ways. You can think that there is actually no temperature, and so you apply these techniques, and then you always look at the limit of the zero temperature. That's the easiest thing to do. On the other hand side, you can actually take it a little bit more seriously, and you can think about it in the following way. There is the equations which we wrote for the neural network, psi I prime equal psi of sum over j, j, simple j. These were deterministic equations. Now, in the real brain, there is a lot of stochasticity, and there are many sources of this stochasticity. It could be either stochasticity in the synaptic transmission, or it could be background activity of other areas which constantly bombards the neurons which you are looking at. So you always have some noisy terms here, plus some eta r of t, which come from all these sources. So you can think about the temperature as being just a measure of the amplitude of these noisy sources. Now, it's not easy to relate it exactly to the temperature. Under some assumptions about the statistical difference, you can show that this can be directly analogous to the temperature, but otherwise this can give you some idea about what will be the role of this noise in the performance of the Hopkins model. And you would expect that in general the noise, the more noise you have, the worse the performance should be, but sometimes people would point to some effects in which the noise would actually be a helpful factor in the performance, and I will show you one of the examples. So that's a so let's then accept me that the noise in the neural networks can be captured by temperature. And we can now, what I want to do is to perform the same analysis there, just to illustrate how the same technique can be now applied to the Hopkins model. So I just compute the free energy exactly the same way as I did it for the magnetic system, and then I'll see what it tells us about the performance of the model. So again, let's write this energy function for this value of the, this is the difference now. Now we have an interaction matrix which is determined by the memories and not either ferromagnetic or anti-ferromagnetic. So if you write this, if you put it into the energy function, what you will get is the following. You have minus 1 over 2 n. So this can be written as minus
shall I repeat it?
Yeah.
Okay, so we can write then the Hamiltonian of the Hopfield model in terms of the overlap. So let me first write it in the next plane. So we introduced here the overlap, which I already mentioned before, 1 over n, sum over I, sigma I, psi I nu. So that's an important quantity. It tells you how closely the current state of the network overlaps with the memory, right? So if this goes from minus 1 to 1, So if it's one, it means that sigma coincides with the memory, because then all the terms will be one here. This will become one. If it's a flipped version of the memory, it will be minus one. And if it's uncorrelated or very weakly correlated, this will be around zero. Okay, so we see that the Hamiltonian now is reduced to the sum of these overlaps, of the squared overlaps. So this is almost like magnetization, right? In that case, we had minus n over 2 j n over 2 mu squared. Here, instead of one magnetization, you have p of them, right? They're the same number as you have memories. And instead of magnetic moment, you have the overlap. But otherwise, it looks similar. So you can estimate the free energy in a very similar way. So again, you write F equals 1 over beta. So if you, okay, 1 over beta log sum over sigma e to minus beta h of sigma. So if you put it here, it's 1 over beta n over 2 Okay, so again, all what matters in the for the Hamiltonian is the overlaps. So all the configurations of the neurons which will produce the same overlaps will contribute the same term to the Hamilton, to this statistical sum. And again, you can define the density function. So you count how many neuron configuration provide exactly the same values of the overlaps, and all of them will have the same contribution. So it will be 1 minus beta. So this sum you can again break into two. You first integrate over all overlaps, each of them from minus to plus 1, e to beta n. So these overlaps were the functions of sigma. So here they become just numbers. Square. So the vector here is goes from 1 to p, and then you have to multiply it by the density of the states. Okay, so this is this counts how many neuron configuration provides the same of the same set of the overlaps. So d of m equals sum over all configurations, this delta function. The product of the delta functions of m mu minus 1 over n sum over I sigma I psi I mu. So now you do the same trick. You present this delta function as an integral. And after you did this, you can take the sum over sigma, because here you have just one neuron problem. You have a you have to take the sum over all possible sigmas, but the exponent here factorizes, so it becomes the product over all i's. So you can take the sum over sigmas here, the same way we did it before. So what you have here is the integral over dx. Here you have sum over mu. Which becomes the scalar product of these two vectors. And here you have to take this sum, which becomes the same, so it will become the product over all I. And here there will be the same sum as we had, so it will be cosinus 2 cosinus of x times psi. Okay, this comes from the sum over sigmas. So if you take this to the exponential, you have integral over dx e to I n x n plus sum over I the logs of all these factors. Okay, and this you have to plug back there. Now you see again, this is proportional to n. This is proportional to n. This is not proportional to n, but this has the form of the sum over all the sides. So it's in a sense, this is proportional to n because there are n sides here. So you can write every sum of this thing. If you assume that the patterns are independent from on one side and the other, you can write it as the n times the average of this. So whenever you have a sum of some function of I, of psi, you can write it as n times the average of this function. And the average is taken on the statistics of psi. For example, in the Hopfield model, it's usually assumed that at any site, independently, you choose the value plus minus 1 with the probability 50%. So then this average will be just averaging this with 50% probability to be plus or minus 1. So this term then also becomes proportional to n. So if you plug it back there, you again have this expression that it will be the log of the integral over dm dx minus n beta some function, which will now depend on x and m. So it looks exactly the same as in magnetic system, except that now you have a vectors here, which have pip components, depending on how many memories you put into the system. And the expression for f as a function of x and m is very similar again. It's the same as you had before. So let me write it here. One minus half m square minus ix m minus beta minus 1 log 2 cos beta x average of psi. So this is the free energy in terms of the overlaps in this auxiliary variables x. And again, if you eliminate x by doing this shortcut, you just take the derivative over m. It gives you the relation that x equals im. So if you plug it there, you have f equals m square over 2 minus beta minus 1 log 2 hyperbolic cosinus beta m psi average of psi. And if you now take the derivative over m, you get the final equations for the overlaps. M equals psi tangens hyperbolic of beta m psi a virtual psi. Okay, so let's look into these equations. So if you solve it, you will know the values of the overlap, or the possible values of the overlap. Now again, this depends on the temperature, so let's for a moment ignore the temperature. So let's go into the limit of the zero temperature. Then the tangent hyperbolic of beta x becomes the sine function of x, right? Because the tangent hyperbolic has this shape, and it becomes sharper and sharper for the zero temperature. When beta goes to infinity, it becomes a very sharp function, so it converges into the sine. And so if you write this equation in the components, what you get is the value of the overlap number mu is given by psi mu, the sine of beta sum over mu and mu psi mu. The sum over psi equals plus minus 1. Okay, so remember, we assume here that all the patterns are created independently one from another, and the chance for each psi mu to be plus and minus 1, let's say, is 50%. Okay, so to take this average, all you have to do is to take for every mu with the equal chance psi to be plus or minus 1. Now, what's the meaning of this equation? This could be actually written down directly, because remember, if you take jij in this shape, in this form, 1 over n psi I mu psi j mu, and if you now compute the input to a neuron, if the system in the state sigma I, if you compute the input, it will be 1 over n sum over I mu psi j mu sigma j. So this becomes the overlap. It becomes sum over I psi I mu m mu. So each pattern contributes weighted by the value of the corresponding overlap. So this is exactly this h here. Okay, so sine is the value of the neuron at this site, right? If h is positive, this is plus 1. If h is negative, this is minus 1. So you take, so this is again becomes the self-consistency equation. If the overlaps have the values m mu, this becomes h. So this thing becomes sigma. So you multiply it by psi mu and average. And this has to be, again, the overlap, right? Because this is the same consistency equation. So these equations become just the self-consistency equation, the same way as the equation for the magnetic moment were the consistency equation in the mean field. This is also the consistency equation. Now we can just look at what kind of solutions you can have here. And there are several types of solutions. What we would like to have is a solution where only one overlap is positive and all the other overlaps are zero, right? Because we want to have a memory retrieved, but we don't want to mix it up with other memories. So, yeah. Excuse me?
Why can I assume that?
Well, I'm just saying that this is the simplest case where you can push the analysis to the end, right? You say, it's up to us to decide here what memories to take. So I'm just saying, let's consider the situation where memories are picked up randomly. And then we can think about what happens if they're correlated and so on. But I just want to give you the case where analysis can be done until the very end. And then we see what intuitions survive in the more realistic case or whatever. Because in principle, there are many possibilities. You can take patterns which are correlated in many, many different ways. So let's just first look at the case where they are uncorrelated. Okay, so let's first look at the solution where mu equals m for mu equal 1 and 0 for all other k. So this is a retrieval. This is called retrieval state. We have just one memory retrieved. All the other memories are not retrieved, suppressed. So if you plug it here, what you get is m for mu equal 1. You have m equals psi 1. And here, from this sum, what you have is just the term is mu equal 1, right? So it will be sine. No beta here, I'm sorry. This is a limit of the infinite, of the zero temperature. M C1 average over psi 1. But look what happens here. Here you have psi times the sine of m psi. And psi is plus minus 1. So if this is positive, if it's plus 1, then this is plus 1. If it's minus 1, this is minus 1. So it means that you can put psi 1 here inside and cancel. So what you have here, so everything is determined by the sine of m. Wait a second, look at it. I think I did the wrong order. Right, so if you just continue here, you have sine of m. And so the solution will be m equal 1. Right, so at zero temperature, you always have a solution where you have a perfect retrieval of the memory and the other memories are suppressed. So if I just did a mistake. I didn't have to take the limit of beta equals to infinity. So in the general case, what you have is the familiar equation of beta m here. Okay, so this is for finite beta. This becomes an equation for infinite beta. Okay, so in the zero temperature, you have a perfect retrieval, which is a nice result. You have many memories. You can put p to be rather big. As long as it is much, much less than the number of neurons you have, and they don't interfere at all with the retrieval of the pattern. And this, of course, this happens because the memories, we have taken them to be uncorrelated. So the overlaps are on the order of 1 over square root of n. And as long as the number of patterns is less than n, you don't have an interference. So in this limit, if you have a very big network, you can have a perfect retrieval of each pattern, even if you have other patterns stored. Okay, so it means that every pattern has a finite, a rather big basin of attraction can be retrieved without interference. Now, the problem is that this is not the only solution. As we saw, the Hopfield model can have other types of solution, other types of minimum, and you can analyze it by looking at this equation. So there are many types of solutions. Let's look at the mixture states. The mixture states is the solution which mixes up several patterns. Yeah. Yeah. This becomes the mean overlap with the pattern number one. Equal.
M coincides or with the pattern?
No, the m is the number between minus 1 and 1s. But if it equals 1, m by definition is 1 over n psi sigma. Okay, so if sigma exactly coincides with psi, you have 1 here. And that's what we got. So we got the overlap equals exactly 1. It means that our state is exactly coinciding with the pattern number 1, right? Could be pattern number 2 or pattern number p, and because they're all equivalent. So this analysis tells you that you have a retrieval state which exactly coincides with no mistakes with the pattern.
Okay, so that's the magnification in function of the input pattern.
That's a possible solution. It means that if you, let's say, as I showed you in an example, if you have a solution of this sort, with different m's, right? You can have a solution 1, 0, 0, 0. Or you can have all perturbations, right? 0, 1, 0, etc. All permutations, because they're all equivalent. So what determines the actual state you will find your network is the initial condition then. If you will prepare initial condition which is close to the first memory, you'll find the network in this state, or in this or in that state. Right? But every time if you just let the network evolve at zero temperature, it will evolve into the pattern which will exactly correspond to the memory. Right? Because this overlap will be one. So you have a perfect retrieval without any errors. Although you have other patterns which in principle could somehow create the noise there, but it's not enough to create even one error. You will not have even one neuron which will be in the wrong state. Okay, that's the conclusion from here. But what I'm now trying to tell you is that if you look at the equations, you can see that you have other solutions. So if you look at this equation, let's say at zero temperature, you can have other solutions which have more than one overlap which is not zero. So for example, you may have a solution like this. You may have a solution with few non-zero overlaps and then the rest zero. So let's say you have n overlaps here which are non-zero and p minus n. Okay, so these are not desired states because this would correspond to the mixture of first three memories. Right? And this would not correspond to any of the memories. But if you take this ansatz and put into the equation, you can see that these solutions also exist, right? So for example, if you put it there, so for mu less than 3, you will get m equals sine mu and for the rest, you will have zero. Okay, can you have this solution? First of all, if you look here, you see that this is satisfied because you have here the average over psi. Here you have the psi with the index which is bigger than 3. And under the sine, you have only the psi's with the index which are less than 3. And since they are independent, you can factorize this sum. And this becomes 0 because you assume that every pattern, every memory has an equal probability to be in the plus 1 or in the minus 1. Right, so this equation is automatically satisfied. And this is very easy to solve. For example, what you can do is you can just sum over mu. So this is the equation for mu equals 1, 2, 3. If you sum it, so what you will get is m equals 3 sum over mu from 1 to 3 sine mu sine of m sum over 1 to 3 sine mu. So this is the same factor here and here. So it's very easy to perform the summation, right? Because the averaging over psi should take all possible combinations, but this is the same factor here and here. So if you can take it as a little exercise to see to write down the solution. So if you just you can write what is the exact formula here. But the conclusion is that this equation have solution of this type, and they have actually, in fact, they have many more. more complicated solutions where different patterns contribute with different weights. Okay, so you have a situation where you have you know some of the minimums, which are good ones, which correspond to the pattern, but you have a lot of mixture states, and one of them we saw when you started, when I showed you the simulation. If you start from random condition, you get some mixture of the patterns which doesn't look as any of them. Okay. Now, this is just the solution. In principle, what you can do is then to take these solutions, plug it into the expression for the free energy, and see if they indeed the minimums of the free energy, because only the stable solutions have a meaning. And then you discover the interesting thing is that different solutions lose their stability at different temperatures. So let me show you the result of the analysis without going into it. This was pretty exciting for some people when they realized that.
Is there like a general proof that you always have mixture states even if you have a different learning rule?
No, you have some networks where they disappear, I think. Let me just draw it for you. So now if you go back to so I just wrote down for you the case for zero temperature, but if you do the same equation, instead of sine, you have a tangens hyperbolic here, and if you solve this equation and plot, for example, the value of the overlap as a function of the temperature, so that's what you get here. So let's plot the value of the overlaps as a function of the temperature for different solutions. So you know that the retrieval solution looks like this, right? Because the equation looks like the ferromagnetic case, right? You have perfect retrieval at zero temperature, and then you have a phase transition at a temperature equal one. So above this, there is no retrieval, and it appears continuously here as a function of the temperature. So this is the retrieval state. Now you have now all the mixtures. So if you plot, for example, if this M for a mixture of three, you plot, it looks like this. So it appears also at the same temperature. So it looks like a bad thing. You, for any temperature below one, you, in addition to the retrieval state, you have a mixture state of three patterns. But if you look at the stability, you see that while the retrieval state is stable for all the temperatures, this is can be done by looking by going to the free energy. This one loses stability at the temperature below one. So let me plot it as a dashed curve here, which indicates that this solution exists, but it becomes unstable. So if you plot M5, this happens even at lower temperature and so on. So what you have here is that if you have a high enough temperature, you can eliminate the mixtures because they become unstable. So there is actually a temperature when out of all of these mixtures, only the retrieval state is stable. So then you can think about it as if you really believe that the temperature can capture the effects of the noise, it means that in some sense the noise can help the network to behave better because it may eliminate the mixture states. So even if you have, let's say, if you prepare your network in the mixture of three patterns, if you increase the temperature, eventually this becomes unstable and it will fall into one of the retrieval patterns. Right? So this is an example where the noise can actually improve the performance by reducing the number of the spurious minimums in the free energy and leaving you with only the right ones. Okay.
So while they're stable, the mixture states have a higher energy than the unique state.
No, they just lose the stability. They always have a higher free energy at all temperatures. But here they stop becoming the minimum. They just the nature of the extremum changes.
At yeah. These higher temperatures, then even the perfect state would be retrieved not perfectly.
Right, so you pay the price. You make more mistakes. And this is because this phase transition is of the second order. Right, so if you reduce the temperature, eventually the retrieval state appears, but it appears with a small overlap. So you have more, you will have errors due to the noise here, but this will be eliminated completely. So you pay the noise, of course, makes it worse in terms of the number of errors, but you will not get stuck into the wrong states. And I'll see that under other conditions, this transition can be of the first order when the overlap will appear with a high amplitude to begin with, but not in this model. In the Hopfield model, the transition is of the second order, so you have a small overlap here. Okay, let me comment now. It looks like I won't have time to really give you the details of how the capacity can be calculated. So the issue here, one of the main issues which was discusses how many patterns can be remembered by the network. So if, let's say, you have a network of a given size and you ask yourself, you add more and more patterns, and as I showed you, if the number of patterns is much less than the number of neurons, the network performs well. But it's clear that eventually, if you overload it, the performance should break down because the interference with the other patterns should become too strong. So how can you compute the capacity of the network in terms of the maximum number of patterns which can be stored? And I will just give you a way of estimating it, although this can also be done with the tools of statistical physics, but I don't have time now to talk about it. So imagine now that you have many, many patterns. So you add more and more patterns here. And the P approaches some big number, which is on the order of the number of the size of the system. So when does the performance break down? So what we want to check is that at what point the memories lose their stability. And the simple way of estimating is, again, is to prepare the network in the one of these memory states and see what kind of inputs the neurons receive from other neurons. So let's say, as I did once, let's prepare the network in one of the states and compute the input which the neuron receives. So hi, again, equals jij psi j1. Equals 1 over n j mu so again we break this into two terms. One is the retrieval term with mu equal 1, which becomes psi I 1, and then there is the interference term with all the rest. Okay, or it could be also written in terms of the overlaps. Between the patterns. Okay, so this is the retrieval term. It has the right sign. If this would dominate, then you would not have to flip any of the neurons, so the pattern would be a stable state. But this has a random sign, because the patterns are random. So it's a random term, and if it becomes of high enough variance, this can overcome this and makes the errors, right? You will start to flip the neurons in the wrong places, and then this can accumulate like an avalanche, and this can drive you away from this state, and the minimum can be in some very different state whatsoever. So the system would not function as a memory here. So how to estimate, and this depends on how many patterns you have. You have few patterns, this term has a small variance, but eventually this becomes bigger than one. So all you have to estimate it roughly, you have just to compute the variance of this noise term and see when it becomes on the order of one. Right, so that's a calculation which you can do in order to determine how many patterns can the network tolerate. So this is easy to do. You just this noise term has a zero average, so all you have to do is to square it and compute the mean. So if you square it and compute the mean, what you have here is 1 over n squared. Psi i mu j k psi j mu psi k mu psi j 1 psi k 1. Then you have to compute the average of this. Right? So I just squared this. So I introduced two extra labels, mu and nu j and k. And mu and nu are not equal to 1. And also j is not equal to I. And also j and k not equal to I. Okay, so now each of the pattern by itself has zero average. So in order to have non-zero terms here, you always have to have them in pairs. So you can see what conditions are here to make them in pairs. So for example, here I stands alone, right? I is not equal to either j or k. So in order to have this pair to have non-zero average, you need a condition that mu equals nu. So only these terms with mu equal nu, they provide non-zero average. Now again here, you have these two patterns stand alone because they correspond to the first part, to the first memory, and mu and nu are not equal to 1. So in order for this term to be non-zero, you need the j equal to k. So only these terms out of the all the possible other terms can have provide give you a non-zero average. Okay, and so then all these pairs will be 1, and you just have to count how many terms you have in the sum. So it will be 1 over n squared. So you'll have summation over mu and summation over j. Summation over mu gives you p, and summation over j gives you another n. So you get p over n. Sometimes it's called alpha. Okay, so the variance of this term is proportional to p over n. And so this already tells you that if p is proportional to n, this term may overcome the signal and the memory will not be retrieved, right? It will not be a stable fixed point. It will not be a fixed point at all. Because even if you start with the memory, the noise will cause the errors and then the errors will accumulate. And it will drive the network out of the of this state. So the conjecture or the guess which you can make from this analysis is that there is a transition, there is a critical number of patterns which is proportional to the number of neurons, so that if you put more patterns than this, the network will stop working properly. Okay, so to compute this number, you cannot with this simple estimate. You have to go and solve the statistical mechanics of the problem, which now becomes more complicated because you have a noisy term here, which has a finite variance, so you cannot ignore it. And then the system, so the problem becomes similar to the spin glass, because the spin glass is a magnetic system where the interactions have a random size. And for this, there was a special technique developed to solve the mean field theory for the spin glasses, which is called replica trick. But apparently, I won't have time to show you this. Question?
Could you assume more different patterns are autonomous?
I assume that the patterns are independent and uncorrelated. Independent means that all the average psi mu factorizes. And then they are also uncorrelated. Each pattern is uncorrelated in terms of the d on the side. So for all sides, psi I mu and psi j mu factorizes if I doesn't equal to j. So you can think about it as picking the patterns by random choice. You just throw the dice every time you want to create the pattern. So what you get from the mean field is that you can compute exactly how many patterns can be stored. I don't think I should really go into this because it should be either done in full or. Okay, we'll see. Maybe we'll do it after lunch. Okay. But I still have some time now before lunch, right? Okay. Say it again? On the time.
So it should depend on the time.
Which time? I don't understand this. There's not. All you do is you check if the memories are the fixed points or not. So this is just that gives you the maximal number of them, and this is just a number, right? You find that the number of patterns which you can store is alpha times n. There is no time here. You just if you put more patterns into the network, then they will just the network sort of collapses. If you they are not fixed points anymore. So even if you prepare your network exactly into the in the memory state, it will go away. So it doesn't function. You will go to some other fixed point, but this can be very far. Right? It's like you had a fixed point, so it had some basin of attraction. Right? But then what happens is that when you add more and more patterns, this basin of attraction shrinks. But still, if you prepare it's right at the pattern or very close, it will stay close. But then eventually, if you pass this will stop being a fixed point at all. So it will go away somewhere. It will find some other fixed point, but this can be very far from the memory. So even if you give the input, which is almost perfect memory, the network cannot carry it, cannot sustain it for some time. It will corrupt it immediately and it will go into some other state.
But before that it will become, so it's like local stability.
It's a local stability.
But before that, it will be global.
Well, I'm not saying it's probably lose a global stability much earlier, but it can still. So let me show you the diagram. What David wanted me to show. This is the result of the full solution. So this shows the diagram of this network. Where here is the temperature, and this is the storing load, the alpha, right? The number of patterns divided by the number of neurons. And you have several states here. So this is both of these states are good. This is a ferromagnet state. where the retrieval state is globally stable. I mean that this is a global minimum of the free energy. This is a mixed phase. So you have here in this phase, the memories are still local minimums. They are not global minimum because the other states may have even lower minimums. And then if you go even to higher load, if you store more and more patterns, they stop being the minimums altogether. Okay, so this difference between these two states is not very important because as long as the memory is a local minimum, it can be stable for a long time. It doesn't really matter if it's a global minimum or not because, as I said, you have barriers which are very big there, and so the system never goes to a global minimum. If it's close to some local minimum, it will stay there forever. So so here there are degenerate global minimums because for every pattern you have the same global minimum. Yeah, they're all equal. Here the global minimum corresponds to no retrieval, so presumably it's just one, although I'm not sure. So this is, so here the global minimum has no overlap with any of the memories, right? But all every memory is still a local minimum, so it can still function as a memory, right? So if you let's go to the limit of zero temperature. So if you go and you have 5% of the memories relative to the size of the network, you still have a global minimum at every of the patterns. Then they become local minimum, so they lose their global stability but still can function as a memory. And then there is another transition here where they are not minimums anymore. So then the system cannot at all function as an associative memory because even if you provide it with an input which is almost like the memory, it will then go away. So you see that you can store up to 14% of the memories. So if you have a network of, let's say, 1,000 neurons, you can store up to 140 neurons, 40 patterns there, and it can still function in the memory. And if you try to store more, you destroy the behavior. Okay. So what I want to do now, before the lunch, I want to discuss a little bit all these approximations and assumptions which were done, which were clearly not realistic, but they were basically introduced to make the analysis possible. So some of them were raised here. So what are these unrealistic assumptions which were done? There are actually very many, but I just list some of them, which are clearly wrong. So first, symmetry. Okay, there is no evidence that the connections in the brain are symmetric. In fact, it's known that there is almost no correlation between the synapses in one direction and another. You may have perfectly neurons which are connected in one direction, and there will be no synapse whatsoever in the other direction. And of course, there is no evidence that the strength should be symmetric. Okay, now another thing is that this assumption that the neurons are binary is clearly not true also, because the neurons have a firing rate, as you heard here many times, which can be an analog variable. It can be low, it can be high. It doesn't have to just assume two discrete values. The third assumption is this independence of the memory. So we said that P of psi equals plus minus 1 equal 0.5. So it means that the neuron has a high, the same chance to be plus 1 and minus 1 at the memory. Now again, there is a lot of evidence which tells that this is not true. That in fact every memory involves only a small fraction of the neurons, right? So indeed this should be a different probability. So the probability that the neuron is on, and the memory should be much less than 0.5. It's not that, what I'm saying is that when you have a memory activated, it's not that half of the neurons in the network will go up. There is only a small fraction of the neurons which will go up, and maybe in the afternoon when we talk about the experiments, I can show you this. And finally, maybe just let's stay with this. So these are the main assumptions, which are clearly wrong. Just from the, even if you don't look at the data, you can say that at least these two assumptions are clearly wrong. And there is it's very reasonable to assume that also this one should be wrong. And the question is whether the Hopfield model is just this toy example, which will completely key eliminate it if you want to eliminate this assumption, or it's actually robust. And there was a lot of activity in trying to understand what is the role. So what effect will relaxing these assumptions have on the performance of the Hopfield model? And the bottom line, which I can tell you, is that in fact you can relax all of them and the model becomes only better. So this was a pretty surprising thing, because people were initially very worried about this. So they thought that, well, if these are very crucial assumptions, so this can not possibly have any relevance for the brain. But it turned out after they found that if you relax all them, the performance can become only better. So let me give you just one example of one of the assumptions which you, if you relax it, it becomes better. So let's take this one. So I say the probability that the memory has a value of 1 should be much less than 0.5, which means that every memory should involve only a small fraction of the neuron. This is sometimes called the sparse memories limit. So if you have a memory, there will be only a few spins which will have plus 1 values. And they will be in the ocean of other neurons which will not participate in the network, in the memory, so they will be minus 1 state. So how does this affect the Hopfield model? So it turns out that if you just write the same matrix of connection, this will not work. And it's very, you can easily understand why it won't work, because if you write Jij equals Psi I mu Psi J mu, and this Psi have now a very small probability to be plus 1. So if you write the input, so it will be again Psi I 1. So let's say you prepare the network in the state Psi I 1, so it will be Psi I 1, the same as we had. But now this noise term doesn't have a zero mean, so now it will grow linearly with the number of patterns. Because now the patterns are not, the correlations between patterns are not zero, right? You have the patterns which have a lot of minus ones there. So the correlation m mu nu will not be 1 over square root of n. They will have a finite value, right? The average of a psi nu. So if, for example, the chance, the probability that the neuron is 1 is f, and the probability that it's 1 minus 1 is 1 minus f. So the correlation here will be, I think, on the order of 1 minus f squared, something like this. Or 1 minus 2f squared. So only if it's 0.5, it will be 0 to the leading order. But if it's much less than 0.5, there will be a finite correlation. So this term will grow linearly with the number of patterns. And so as a result, the number of patterns which you can store is on the order of 1, right? Because this term grows as p, and eventually it will overcome this term, and it will create the errors. Okay, so it looks like everything breaks down. The Hopfield model cannot realize these patterns which have sparse coding, right? The sparse patterns cannot be stored, but you can actually very easily fix it by changing the representation. So let's now, and it turns out that if you have this situation where only a few neurons are up and the rest are down, let's denote the neurons which are down to be zero. And it turns out that's important for the model. Also makes more sense biologically because these neurons have zero firing rate, so it's more reasonable to denote them as zero. And so you have psi I mu equals either 1 or 0, and this has probability f, and this has probability 1 minus f. So you have just a little bit to change the Hopfield matrix. You have to write it as jij equals 1 over n. And every turn you have to subtract the average value here. Okay, so this is a slightly modified version. You subtract the average, and then you can do the similar estimation of how many patterns can be stored. So let's assume again that you start with the first one, you plug it here, you compute the input which each neuron receives, and so what you get is 1 over nf. From 1 to p, so again we break it into two terms, one for mu equal 1 and the rest, so you have 1 over nf psi I mu psi 1 minus f plus the rest. I don't write it here, just okay, this term is the average of psi times psi minus f. So you can if we continue here, it's 1 minus f times average psi minus f plus the noise term. So this average, this is 1 with probability f and 0 with probability 1 minus f. So if you compute it, it becomes psi square, but it's 0, 1, so it's like psi. The average of this is f minus f square. So it's approximately 1, right, for small f. So the signal term is 1. And if you compute the so the signal term is psi minus f. So what you have here, let me write it a bit more carefully. So the input which the neuron will receive will be psi I1 minus f, signal term, plus Ri. And if you compute carefully the variance of this noise term, it will be proportional to f times p over n. And the average of it will be 0. So now how many p's, what is the highest p which you can store? So now you should look at the case where this will overcome the signal. The signal will be different depending on whether psi is 0 or 1. So if it's 1, the signal will be 1 minus f. If it's 0, the signal will be minus f. So it looks like you have to compare the variance of the noise with the smallest value of the signal, because if you will make a mistake here, this will be bad. But the, you may recall that in fact you can add the thresholds here. We analyzed the model where the thresholds were zero, but in principle you could, as I said, you can compare it with the threshold. So you can add a threshold, and adding the threshold will be just shifting all of the signal. So if you adjust it correctly, let's say you take threshold about 1/2, so the signals will become on the order of 1. And so the performance will break down if this noise term will become bigger than 1. And so the maximal value of, according to this analysis, will be proportional to n over f. Okay, so these rough estimates give you the capacity, which now becomes better and better if the memories become sparser and sparser, right? The more neurons participate in each of the memories, the more of the memories you can store. And if you do a careful analysis with statistical mechanics, you find that there is an extra log here, which makes it a little bit worse, but still you have an improvement of the capacity for this in the sparse limit. The more and more sparse the memories become, the more and more you can solve them. Moreover, if you again do the analysis carefully, what you find is that the transition becomes the first order, not the second order. So if you plot the value of the overlap as a function of alpha, which is p over n, so in the case of the Hopfield model, there was a phase transition of the second order, so the memories appeared with small overlap. But here what happens is that they appear immediately with the overlap, which is almost 1. So you have this pattern here. And this is the critical capacity, which is on the order of 1 over f, log 1 over f. Okay, so it makes it better in two respects. First, you can put more memories into the network, and then it improves the quality of the retrieval all the way to the critical capacity. So all the way to the critical capacity, you have a retrieval which is almost 1. Say it again. I don't know. No, I can only do this analysis in the limit of f, which is much less than 1. So if you have a finite f, apparently there will be some crossover. So I don't know what will happen. I never looked at it. But if you go to the limit of very sparse coding, sparse memories, then you have a transition of the first order. And you can estimate from the experimental data what is the relevant value of f, and you get with the estimate of about 1%. I will show you the picture. Now, the last picture which I have here is how some of the experiments which can allow you to estimate this roughly again. Okay, so making the memories sparse make it better. Now, what about symmetry condition? It looks like a very crucial condition.
So each pattern that has less information.
That's true, yeah. In some sense, yeah. You can, if you estimate the capacity in terms of information, then of course it should remain finite. So if you, I don't know, if it would probably take me some time to explain what's the information capacity. But you can think about it this way. So if you have a memory which is a sparse, the amount of information you have in the memory is smaller, right? Because you have less, so let's say you have only nf ones out of n possibilities, and so the entropy of this set is smaller. It's about f log f. So it's not surprising. So it's maximum for f equals 1/2. So it's not surprising that if you have a sparse memories, you cannot store more of them, but the amount of information actually remains the finite. So if you plot the capacity as a function of sparseness, it diverges here because it's 1 over f log f. But if you multiply the number of patterns by the information which it contains in each of the patterns, it also grows with the sparseness, but it approaches the finite limit here. So you have an improvement, but it's not going to infinity. Okay, now the symmetry. The symmetry looks like a very crucial assumption, because if you don't have a symmetric connection, you are not guaranteed that you will have a fixed points at all. But it turns out, when people looked at it, it turns out that the asymmetric networks work just as well. And this was noticed first by Hochfeld in the simulations, that actually you don't need the symmetry condition. And the analysis shows that if you say that you have Jij, which is a Hochfeld one, but you multiply it by dilution factors, like some Sij, and you say that this is most of the time is zero, and only randomly it's one, and it's independently from I to J, so you asymmetrically dilute the Hochfeld network, then what you can find is that it still can retrieve the memories. Now, they're not necessarily the fixed point, so instead of having an absolute minimum here, the network may go randomly around some state, but it will always be close to the memories. And this would require a very complex analysis to illustrate this. But in simulations, it's very easy to see that you can have situations where the network goes chaotically around the state which has a high overlap with the memory. So this is also not a critical assumption. I don't know. I didn't do the scaffold simulations. But as long as you still have a macroscopic number of connections per neuron, this is fine. Now, if you go down to having finite number of connections per neuron, you're going into a different regime. But as long as the number of connections is, I think it should be bigger than log n or something like this. You can practically, yeah, clearly delete 90% of the connections. Okay, finally, we'll have a discussion in the evening about the experiments, but I just want to show you two of the overheads to illustrate how can you see the things in the experiment. So, yeah, that's another thing, that all these matrices, they violate the Dale law, that the neuron can either be excitatory or inhibitory. Here you have one neuron which is exciting one neuron, but it can inhibit the other ones. And there are also ways around it, but it's too much for me to give all the all these extensions in one talk. But people found the ways to solve this problem either. Okay, let me show you just one example, one figure from the experimental work. This is from the lab of Miyashita in Tokyo. So he was training the monkeys to perform the delayed memory task. He was showing the monkeys pictures, and then after some delay, he was showing another picture, and the monkey had to decide if it was the same picture or not. Okay, so this is the simplest way, or most reasonable way to study the memory, is that the monkey was seeing this kind of pictures, and the monkey had to remember it for a few seconds until the next picture was shown. Yeah, very, very artificially looking scene. So this was the protocol of the experiment. So the monkey was seeing the picture, then there was a delay, and then it was seeing another picture, and the monkey has to tell if the second picture is the same one as the first one or not. So clearly, in the delay period, it has to remember the picture, and then they made the recordings in the IT area of the visual cortex. This is the area where you have these face cells and object cells and so on, the highest level of visual processing. And they did found the neurons which were firing with high rates during this delay. Okay, so look at this neuron. So under the presentation of one of the pictures, you see it was responding to it, and then for the 16 seconds, which is a very long time for a neuron, it fired with a rate of about 10 spikes per second, while before it was almost not firing at all. And this lasted for 16 seconds. Now, this was selective, so the same neuron, when the other picture was shown, almost didn't fire. Again, there was some elevation of the activity, but it was much less than in this case. And so if you put the histogram of these delay rates for a neuron over all of the patterns, so they prepared like hundreds of patterns of this artificial thing, and then the monkey was trained on them. So the monkey saw these patterns many, many times. So presumably it learned them very well. And then if you look at the histogram of this delay firing rates for a given neuron, that's what you get. So you have overall 100 patterns, but you see that most of them didn't produce any significantly increased the delay activity. There were only few of them out of 100 which actually produced the higher rate. So it means that the neuron participated in the representation of only few patterns out of 100. Okay, so this tells you that this is a sparse memories, because for every picture you have only a few percent of the neurons which actually participated in the coding for this. Now, interestingly, if you go to a new pattern, so if you generate now the new set of patterns which look like this, but were never shown to the monkey before, none of them can elicit the high delay activity. So it means that you really need to, the monkey had really to learn this pattern, so to experience them many, many times to create this kind of persistent activities. So presumably it had to learn them by forming some connections, and only under this condition. Okay, so this is a type of experiments which can somehow be related to the models. And
the neuron was active, or the overlap between them was significant?
Say it again?
So this one neuron is active for multiple patterns, and is there some similarities between those patterns?
So the patterns were created completely in a completely random way. So now you're asking, what are these specific patterns which were effective, right, which led to a higher rate? And it turned out that there was nothing in the shape of the patterns which would predict it, but in fact there was some factor. The factor which was most correlated with the activity was the order of this pattern. So these patterns were learned in a specific order, right? So they were labeled. The monkey didn't have to know about it, because the experiments didn't require from the monkey to notice any of the order. But then after you test, so you do it before you do recordings, and then so it learned them all in one order. And then if you look at the which patterns elicited the highest activity in the delay, you saw that these were the patterns which were neighbors there. So apparently the monkeys, although the monkey didn't have to pay attention to the order, the representations which were created were sensitive to the order. And this is again one of the things I didn't have time to talk, maybe afternoon. How could this come about? Because in the Hopfield model you see that the order in which the patterns are learned have no importance, right? You create the matrix which is symmetric to reshuffling. But here clearly what happened is that the neurons were sensitive to the order in which the patterns were learned. So if there was a cluster of patterns which produced this higher activity rate, so two clusters here, one cluster here, so you can translate it into some sort of correlations. You can compute the correlations between the representations as a function of the separation between or the distance between the patterns in this loop, and you see that the patterns which were neighbors up to 5, after the separation of 5, are somehow creating the correlated representations. Again, if I have time afternoon, I can talk about it. So there is something here which goes beyond the Hoeffel model. Okay, we will talk much more about the experiments afternoon. And we have Udi Zohari, who is actually doing this kind of experiments. He'll show you more data from his lab. Thank you.